Today is Harold's mother's 18th Yahrzeit, and he's brought some kibbutz here for dessert that we should enjoy. And we're going to be learning Le'ilui Nishmat
Miriam Bat Tzvi Hirsch.
So the learning should be a source of nechama for the neshama and aliyah for the neshama, and put fond memories into the man. I'd like to take a look at, the whole relationship between Yaakov and Lavan. Because Parshat Vayitzeh, just a few introductory words about Parshat Vayitzeh. Parshat Vayitzeh is one parasha. And I know that sounds like a little tautological, but it's not. Seder Vayitzeh is one parasha. You open up the Sefer Torah, you see Vayitzeh Yaakov. And the next time you see a break is after the word Machanaim, which is the end of Vayetze. It's all one piece. And if you were to give a blurb to what Parshat Vayetze is, it is Yaakov's years with Lavan. And it's constructed elegantly. A few years ago we talked about the structure of this parasha. It begins with Yaakov leaving, fleeing an enemy, and stopping somewhere and having a vision in which he sees angels, and he renames the place based on the vision. It ends with him fleeing an enemy who's trying to kill him, and he has a vision and he sees angels and he renames the place. Associated with both of those scenes, there is a pile of rocks that have some significance and a gal'ed and a matzeva of sorts. And then towards the middle on each side, there is an interaction with Lavan. First there's the 14 years for the wives, then there's the 6 years for the tzon. And smack in the middle of the whole thing is the story of the children, which is, and the pinnacle is reached when Yosef is born, and then everything turns around. So the whole thing is one big chiasmus. It's beautiful, and it's actually shaped somewhat like the sulam that Yaakov saw in his dream, which of course is really nice. But I want to take a fresh look at Lavan. Well, the reason I want to take a fresh look at Lavan is something we were actually talking about before Shir in a different angle, which is that for different reasons, Lavan is painted in Midrashic literature and later as one of the worst guys to ever live. The best example of that is how we introduced the Haggadah, but besides that, Lavan is really painted terribly. And we have the following tendency and really orientation, which is that when we meet a character whose behavior is bad, even if it's bad at the end of his life, we will turn around and interpret everything he's done till that point, even as a young person, as being part of that same devious nature. Now, that's not to say that we really think that's how the person lived their lives, because we understand a person's life is dynamic and a person grows, and a person can start out stalwart and upright and ethical and turn into a lout, and we understand people can do the opposite and turn themselves around. And yet, when we meet somebody whose end is ignoble, then we go back and read them that way. So the last time that we see Lavan, sort of, you picture a guy who's really angry and he's got his fist clenched, and Yaakov is walking away sheepishly, pun intended, and Lavan is saying, "I could have gotten you, but your God stopped me." You got to get this picture, and he's this really terrible guy. So we go back to the first time we met Lavan. What was the first time we met Lavan? When the slave came to get a wife for Yitzchak, and her father and her brother, and the brother is the one who plays the dominant role there, and right away we see that, and instead of seeing it, it's like, look how protective he is of his sister, look how much he's trying to help. Instead, look how chutzpahdik he is, that he's talking this way in front of his parents, and he's stepping on their toes, as it were. And then, and as a real sharp example of this, when Lavan comes out to greet the man who turns out to be the slave, he embraces him. What does the Midrash say about that embrace? He was trying to see if he had any gold hidden in his mouth, in his pockets, right? He's trying to pick his pocket. Now, this is reading backwards and saying, oh, you know, we know what kind of guy Lavan is, so we're going to read him that way the whole time. However, that's Lavan of the Midrash. We've talked about this a number of times, of the way that characters take on a whole different personality in Midrash, and there's a good reason for that. And there's a lot of wisdom in it. However, the Darshan himself, and hopefully his audience, and certainly we, are aware that the Lavan of the Midrash is not Lavan of the text, just like Esav of the Midrash, not Esav of the text. Esav of of Ovadia is not Esav of Yirmiyahu, which is not Esav of Bereshit either. You know, its characters get developed after their lives into somewhat of a caricature in order to highlight certain things. And so, for instance, we have in the past taken a look at Yosef and Yosef's growth. And Yosef starts out one way, and then he develops into this great leader, but there were a lot of bumps in the road. And to watch the bumps and how Yosef learned from the bumps and developed is a really fascinating thing. And it goes in a different direction than much Midrash that would have Yosef already be somewhat Yosef HaTzadik from birth. So I want to take a look at Lavan also that way. And the focus really is going to be Lavan, not Yaakov, but the relationship between Lavan and Yaakov. We immediately... What?
Isn't the same approach to Noach? How many parts of the Midrashim are there about
Noach? Really is pretty much ignored by Chazal in that light, as character identity. There's a lot of Midrashim about the events of Noach, meaning about the Mabul and about the event afterwards and you know, the terrible thing in the tent. But there's not so much Midrashim that are like character evaluations of Noach. Noach seems to be something of a stick figure in Tanakh. The first character that we really encounter who's an actor is Avraham. And from then on, they're all actors. Lot is an actor. Yishmael is an actor. Hagar is certainly an actress. You know, they're all active people. And then Chazal come in with their evaluations of them and kind of typecasting them. But let's take a look at Lavan himself. So we have to remember that this entire episode of Yaakov going to Lavan was all Rivka's idea. We talked about this last week, that Rivka seemed to engineer the entire bracha theft in order to get Yaakov to go to Lavan's house. And it may indeed have been, and this is just expanding on what we said last week, it may have indeed been in order for her to recapture a place in the household from which she was taken or she left under, shall we say, devious terms. In other words, she was misled about why she was leaving. So perhaps this is her way of kind of getting back into the household. But let's see what plays out. Notice that both in source 1 and source 2, that both Rivka and Yitzchak direct Yaakov to go to Lavan. The Beit HaLevi has a very famous question on the first pasuk of this parasha. Etzei Yaakov Yerashav Elech Harana. And a very famous question Rashi asks is that it doesn't need to say both Vayetzei and Vayelech. It just said Vayelech Harana. So Rashi says what Rashi says. The Beit HaLevi has a famous, I guess you can't call him Beit HaLevi. So the Beit HaLevi says that Yaakov was really doing two different things. He was both going to Haran because he needed to go there, but he was also fleeing Beersheba. So each half of the pasuk is reflecting part of his mission. Normally when you go somewhere, you're either going to get there or you're going to leave where you are. He was doing both. And that's reflected in these first two pasukim. The Rivka has him flee to Lavan, and Yitzchak has him go to Lavan in order to marry one of his daughters. All right, but now when he gets to Haran, what does he see? So that's the source 3, and we want to take a look at the beginning of his arrival in Haran because it's going to tell us a lot. He comes to Haran, he sees the shepherds outside, and he says, do you know Nahor? And do you know, sorry, Lavan? He says, yes, and Lavan ben Nahor, yes, I know Lavan. So what's the first thing he hears about Lavan? That he's got a daughter who is shepherding. Immediately, Shma minat plat. To quote Gemara, you can infer three things from that pasuk. What things can you infer?
No sons.
Has no sons. Or at least no sons of age, right? Good. What else? He's got a relatively small flock. Right? Because he's got a girl leading the flock. I don't mean the fact that it's a girl. It's got one person. And we're going to learn later that she's relatively young. So it's got to be a relatively small flock. What's the third thing you learn from him? Is he rich or poor?
He's breeding.
What? Is he rich or poor, though? He's poor. If he was rich, he'd have a shepherd. Right? Exactly. So we can right away infer three things about him. One of them, we may need a little time to find out that Rachel is young to understand that that it must be a small flock, but either way, Lavan is not riding a high wave of success here. This is a grazing area. There's other people out there, ranchers. And he's not necessarily doing all that well, but he's evidently a well-known person enough that the other guys know him, and they know his daughter, and they know that his daughter, by the way, is the shepherdess. All right, good.
Maybe he's just really stingy. We don't know that.
We don't know that, correct. But stingy reaches a point at which it becomes counterproductive. In other words, if I've got 4,000 sheep, and I want to save money, and I have my 12-year-old kid watch them, that's not stingy. That's just dumb. Because very soon I'm going to have 1,000 less sheep.
Well, you also
right?
think he has a few, because if he had more, they'd have enough people to roll the rock off.
More what?
More shepherds.
Well, there's a bunch of other shepherds there, and they don't roll the rock off either.
Oh, they're rain family.
Right,
they
yeah.
But he say Levan Achi Imo twice on the next passage?
A good question. Vayika Shiraya Yaakov Rachel Bat Levan Achi Imo. And this, of course, is very impressive because we were just told that they cannot get access to the water until they all show up and they all roll the rock off. And he rolls the rock on his own and he gives water to them. Right, good. So there's an emphasis on that. And the emphasis on that may indeed be to connect, to make this strong connect, family connection. Okay. And of course, here we again interpret that, you know, he's looking for gold. All again. But this is Lavan coming out to greet his nephew, right? And so he tells Lavan, called Vaimaila, which we don't know what that means. May mean I was just out there and I saw Rachel, and maybe I rolled the rock, and maybe I'm running away from Esau who wants to kill me. What does that mean? He says, you're my flesh and blood, right? So he stays there for a month, and evidently during that month, Yaakov starts on his own doing some herding. Yaakov is already a shepherd, so this is known to him. He knows that Rivka comes from a family of herders, so there's nothing new. All right? So that means that Yaakov's already working for him, and Lavan is the one who comes and say, what, you're going to work for free? What do you want? Now, by the way, I'm sorry, I'm pointing out, this makes Lavan the good guy.
Yeah.
In other words, this makes Lavan, he's initiating and volunteering to pay Yaakov for his work, whereas Yaakov could easily say, look, I was told to run away and come here and get refuge. I got a safe haven here. So in lieu of the room and board, I'll work.
Right.
And Lavan's saying, no, I got to pay you. Nice. All right, now what happens? Lavan has two daughters. That's an interjection. Shema Gdola Leah and Shema Ktana Rachel. Ve'inei Leah Rakot. What do we hear about Leah? Ve'inei Leah Rakot. She has tender eyes. Why does she have tender eyes?
She cries a lot.
Why? What does one have to do with the other? Simple explanation is, she's a girly girl. She's got soft eyes.
She's also not a shepherd.
What? So exactly. Rachel Haita Yifat Torah, Yifat Mareah. In the meantime, what do we hear about Rachel? She's good looking, but Yifat Mareah also has to do with figure. In other words, it sounds like Leah's indoors, maybe taking a little more manly, you know, fancy with her face, and that Rachel's more the top. But Rachel's certainly the one who's outside with the flock, which, by the way, is surprising. Who should be out with the flock if there's no boys?
The oldest.
Because she's the oldest. But in the meantime, it's Rachel. So the two girls, although they are, you know, both daughters of the same man, and at this point, the only kids we hear about in the family, and evidently no brothers, we don't hear about sisters either, seem to be quite different in at least their metiot, their interests or whatever. Okay, so what happens? Yaakov says to Lavan, "Evodcha b'sheva shanim Rachel bitcha ktana." Parenthetically, how old is Rachel now? At this point. Well, how old do you think Rachel is?
12.
If she's 12, then that means Lavan is locking away 7 years of childbirth. Not likely. She's likely around 5 or 6.
And she's a shepherd.
Okay, good. So we'll talk about that.
How's that?
All right, we'll talk about that. So she's likely around 5 or 6. How do I know 5 or 6? Because at what age did girls get married in the ancient world?
Puberty.
Around puberty, around 12 or 13.
Yeah.
Lavan is agreeing to have Rachel wait 7 years before she marries Yaakov. Now, Lavan could also say, and he does say this in the end, he could also say, look, Rachel is 11. So you work for me for 7 years for her. In a year, you marry her and then work another 6 years. But he doesn't. And so evidently, Rachel is 7 years away from marriage age. That makes her around 5 or 6. How old is Leah at the time?
Older.
A couple years older.
A little bit older. What's the assumption at the time? It's critical for understanding. What's the assumption at the time about what's going to happen by the time the 7 years are done and Rachel's ready to get married?
She'll be married.
Leah will already be married, probably work on her second kid. Right? First kid, whatever. But she'll already be married. And so Yaakov's interested in Rachel, so that's a 7-year deal. Okay, fine. So we know what happens. And he works for her. And take a look at Pasuk Chavav. Yomayakova Lavan Havat Ishti Ki Malu Yamai Vavoy Leha. Just a parenthetic note, because I'll pick up on it. Somebody's trying to pick up on this. This is not really a nice way to talk. It comes after 7 years, says, okay, where's my wife? I want to have relations with her. It's a little bit of a grub way to talk. So now what does Lavan do? Asof Lavan had called Shem Akom Vayas Mishteh. He makes a party. Now, in the Midrashim, and again, which is operating on a whole different level and layer of understanding the text, which has its own agenda and its own wisdom and its own truth, no question, there are all sorts of machinations going on here to make this work, including machinations between Rachel and Leah, the famous Simanim Midrash, and machinations between Lavan and Leah, maybe, and machinations between Lavan, according to some, and the partygoers, so that nobody tells Yaakov what's going on. Now, in the meantime, Leah is the one who's waiting for him in the marital bed or the room or wherever it is. By the way, Yaakov does not know it's Leah. What does that tell you about Yaakov? Or about Yaakov and Leah and Rachel? What does that tell you?
He doesn't know Rachel that way.
He doesn't know Rachel in any intimate way, which... that's fine, that's good. We're good with that. He also very likely has not seen Rachel very much over the past few years. What's he been doing for Lavan?
Shepherd.
He's been herding. Now, this is where, and the title of this is what the ancient world has to tell us, is we actually have herding contracts from the ancient world from this part of the world, herding contracts from this period. And we know, for instance, that herding was not a 9-to-5 job. In some cases, it was a months-long excursion where you would go out grazing for months until you finally came back. So it's very possible that Yaakov was gone for long stretches at a time.
Yeah, if you want to see that in action, Brokeback Mountain, regardless of all the other stuff, has great depiction of that.
Of being gone for a long time.
Out far away for a long time, winter and all that, and seeing exactly...
Right, and you're gone for a long time. I mean, City Slickers is a main of that, and far more entertaining. But... correct. No, that's important to understand that. And so it's very likely that Yaakov really was not familiar with that familiar. And a girl between 5 and 12 changes a lot. So it's not surprising that he was able to be fooled. But then in the morning, he realizes Leah. He comes running to Lavan, and what does he say? Now, we get our backup. We get upset. And we, of course, are cheering on, give me a J, or give me a Y, or give me a Yod. But in the meantime, listen to the back and forth that goes on. Vayomer Lavan lo yasachen bimekomenu lateta tzi'ira lifnei habechira. What does Lavan say to Yaakov? We don't do that here. What's the here point?
He's talking about local custom.
Right. So first of all, how long have you been here, Yaakov? You've been here 7 years. You've been to some weddings, you've seen. You know what our local customs are? I mean, you've been here this long. Don't you pay attention to local customs? Didn't you notice the fact that Rachel has an older sister that for some reason hasn't yet gotten married? What did you think was going to happen? And the truth is, in this conversation, Lavan really has the high moral position.
Well,
right?
His language.
What?
His language.
Yeah.
Bimkomenu, they're contrasting to any.
Exactly. And what's the Bimkomenu? It is a bit of a musser there that maybe in your place you pretend to be your older brother and you steal bracha. We don't do stuff like that here. We play it straight here. So you understand. Now, Chazal are sensitive to this in a different way. That also, but also in a different way, is that Chazal had the following conversation go on between Yaakov and Leah that first morning. It's a phenomenal midrash. Yaakov wakes up and there's Leah, and the first thing he says is probably, but the second thing he says is, You liar. The whole time I was saying Rachel, Rachel, and you were saying yes. And she turns to him and says, Big Shot. The whole time your father was saying Esav, Esav, and you were saying yes. It's a great midrash. It's been phenomenal. But, you know, it's... So, in this conversation, Lavan is coming out really on top, and then he turns around to Yaakov and says, okay, you know what? Give her her week. Well, Yaakov's married the other one. We're also not so happy with the way Lavan talks about his daughters. In other words, wait a week, give Leah her Sheva Brachot, her week of celebration, that's what it is, and then marry Rachel, and then you work another 7 years to work off Rachel. Fine. All right. This is where, I don't know, little kids always seem to come to the impression that there was a 7-year gap between the weddings, and I don't know where that came from. But it so makes no sense in the story, besides that it's not true in the Psukim. But in any case, that's what's going on here. Now, Yaakov is working for Lavan, meaning all the profits of what he does, all the expansion of flock, which we now find out becomes big as a result of Yaakov, who is a very, very dedicated herder and a smart herder and a smart breeder. Suddenly the flock explodes, got huge numbers, and Lavan admits it and says, you know, you're the cause of my sudden wealth. And in the meantime, Yaakov is not getting any capital from this. Yaakov has got a place to live, another part of the family. What is the vision of what's going to be going on in the future? So let's go back to the beginning. Yaakov arrives, and who's shepherding? Rachel. Who else is in the family? Leah. That's it. By the way, Rachel means you, and Leah means cow. There's something interesting about the names. But that's who's shepherding, Rachel. And there's Leah. There's no sons, evidently. So what's the assumption about what's going to happen here? So here again we go to ancient herding contracts, and we find out that then when there was a man who did not have any sons, he would take another man, sometimes a son-in-law, sometimes just another man, and adopt him as a son for purposes of inheriting and taking over the estate. So now let's put ourselves into that time frame, and without knowing, again, like we have to always do, without knowing how things are going to play out, and without knowing that Yaakov is eventually going to come back, and the Shechem story, and coming back to Beit El, and then Hebron, and then ultimately Mitzrayim, and etc. But just looking at it from within this picture, what do we expect is going to happen? Yaakov is going to stay there. Yaakov is going to become wealthy. At no point does Yaakov need to make his own money, because he already is. Because he is growing the estate, which will be his. And he's going to be the estate. And by the way, it works out very well, because coincidentally or otherwise, he's married both of the boss's daughters, which means they're all in one family now. That makes sense. And now he's having all these sons. These are all sons who are now going to work on the farm, on the ranch. It works very well. And we see that at the end of Perek Lamed, where it says, Vayifrotz Aish, Aish Meor Meor, Vayilot Son Rabot, Ushfachot Vavadim Ugvalim Vachamorim. Now, this happens after a particular point, though. At a particular point, Yaakov says, I want to leave. I want to leave. And since I want to leave, and we don't know why, but I'm going to give a hint as to why I think that the reason is, since I want to leave, therefore I now have to create capital for myself. So in other words, I worked off the 14 years, and I suggested those 14 years happen a long time before all the kids are born, and then Yaakov is living there and doing his own thing. But now he's got to earn some capital because it's time for him to go. Why? With the birth of Yosef, he suddenly wants to go back. Why? That's something to do with Brit Benabatarim, perhaps. He wants to go back. So but I think there's something else going on. And he wants, so now he says, now, Matayas Anochi Leveti. And then he and Lavan enter into an agreement. What's the agreement? I'm going to take certain kind of sheep. You'll take the other kind of sheep. We'll separate them. And we're dividing it up. And now, whichever, you know, if that one grows more, then, you know, those are going to be mine. And that's a reasonable division of labor. And Lavan starts out by saying, you name the price. And he says, I know that God has blessed this house because of you. He owns up to it. So it's not like he turns around and says, what do you mean, Yaakov? You haven't done a thing for me, and now you want half my flock? He says, I recognize that. Okay, we'll divide it up. Again, Lavan's playing it all straight. Turn the page and see what changes. And it changes the beginning of Perek Lamed Aleph, and I think this is why Yaakov decided to leave when Yosef is born. We never heard about these guys before. And this is, again, a problem of knowing too much. We know the whole text, so we assume, of course, everybody in the text was always there. But they weren't. Who does Yaakov overhear?
B'nei Lavan.
B'nei Lavan. Who are B'nei Lavan? So Lavan evidently had sons at some point in time. And now B'nei Lavan are old enough to be concerned about certain things and to be seeing certain things and to be talking about certain things. And what is it that concerns them? Take a look. Vayishma et divrei B'nei Lavan lemor lakach Yaakov et kol asher le'avinu. Shel avinu asad kol hakavod hazeh. I don't mean to trivialize this because it's not trivial at all. But this whole thing boils down to an estate. It's a huge estate. And what are B'nai Lavan complaining about? Yaakov's taken everything. Why are they saying Yaakov's taken everything? Because the impression here is that here we have an estate. Up until now, Yaakov really was the only heir. But now we're the heirs. And by the way, blood is thicker than Yaakov. And thicker than lentils. Right? So, it's actually not. But Lavan is now caught in a somewhat impossible tear. He's had this long-standing relationship with Yaakov, who was assumed to become the next paterfamilias, and then he's got, later, at some later point, his own sons. I think that's the point at which Yaakov decided to leave, when Lavan suddenly had sons, and suddenly the whole relationship has changed. And now he's not going to be the one to inherit. It's time to go on. Maybe that was even his sign. Hold on one second. So he says, he realized what happens. That's what they're saying. So what does Yaakov do? And look carefully at the words. It's really right there. I put the bad words in red. I mean, the angry words in red. Yaakov calls his wives. He calls his wives out to the field. Very famous thing. Rashi says, "Kedamri in Shiel's Naim Lakota." Right? The walls have ears. So when you, Rashi and Brachot, right, that you talk, probably talk outside. Go outside and talk. Right? That tells you everything you need to know. So what does Yaakov say to his wives? I see your father, and what does that mean?
He was a good guy.
Right. We had a great relationship, and it soured. It's not like I realize he was always a devious SOB. No. He used to be good, and now things have changed. And we know what's changed. B'nai Lavan is what's changed. And a question of claiming over the what owns it. And now God, he says to them, in other words, God is enriching me. In other words, Lavan was going to enrich me. I mean, I grew the estate, but he was going to adopt me. Now, God is enriching me. Why? Because every time that we make a negotiation, that's the sheep that grow. That's the miracle here. Right?
Problem.
Yeah?
Two things. One is, he's saying Kitmol Shalshon, but then 2 seconds later he says Maskurati Aser Monim, that 10 times he changed his wages, which means it doesn't seem like it was very positive.
Not necessarily. It just means that we renegotiated the thing and I went along with it, right? Okay. However, every time it went along with it, God has always favored me, and whatever deal was my side of it was the one that multiplied.
Yeah, but he's saying deceived me. He say Hatelbi. I don't know what the English is, but I mean,
okay, good, very good. So I think we have to look back at what Kitmol Shalshon means. Kitmol Shalshon does not mean yesterday and the day before. It's a biblical idiom for saying all the way back.
Right.
So it could be that Yaakov is saying, I now realize that of late things have changed, and here's how I realize of late things have changed. Lately, he's been doing this thing where a ceremony might not mean 10 times; it may be just an exaggeration of saying
right.
He keeps changing the deal on me. And he's working badly with me. This may be not in spite of, but the explanation. How do I know that he's no longer favorable to me? Because now he's been doing this. So in other words, it used to be we had a great relationship, but now things have changed, and I know why things have changed. And then he says, I saw a chalom, and in the chalom, the malach said to me, I have to go back and fulfill the neder, right? And what do the girls say? Ha'od lanu chelek v'nachala b'veit avinu. What do the girls ask?
What about our inheritance?
Do we have an inheritance, right? And look what they say. We are like strangers to him because he sold us. What do you mean he sold us?
7 years.
To
Hittia. Right. In other words, instead of having a nice wedding like that, we were barter. Mm-hmm. Right? Which, by the way, may tell you that was not the norm and that was not necessarily expected. Ki chola osher asher yitzil Elohim me'avinu lanu hu banenu. Now they make an interesting chat. They said, you're claiming, Yaakov, that Hashem took all of Lavan's wealth and gave it to you. Guess what? That was ours. That was really ours. Why was that really ours? Because Lavan only had two daughters, and we'd be the ones to inherit, and it was really ours. And what happened is that you married us, so you stayed in the family, so it was going to still become ours. Now that the brothers have come along, everything's messed up the card. However, God is now favoring you, but he's not giving you something that wasn't yours. He's giving you our stuff. That's their claim. So they both are making a claim on this estate, saying we really have a stake in this estate, but we've lost the stake. Now, retrospectively, and this was not necessarily Lavan's intent, retrospectively, Lavan is the one who did this to them because instead of giving them proper marriage, he sold them, and the notion is that he sold them out of the family. Now, he didn't sell them out of the family because they were in the family, but Bnei Lavan show up, and now Yaakov has to leave. They're suddenly out of the family, which leads us to the bizarre thing that happens at the end of this parsha. At the end of this parsha, as they're leaving, and I have it in the green here, Rachel goes in and sneaks and takes the trafim. Why does Rachel take the trafim? So we're familiar with what some midrashim say is that Rashi quotes it, she was trying to prevent Lavan from doing Avodah Zarah. That's an example we were talking about before Shiur, right? If she's trying to prevent Lavan from doing Avodah Zarah, then first of all, it's kind of like they say about killing a terrorist. You don't have 10 more take his place. It's easy to make more trafim. Second thing is, if she's trying to prevent her father from doing Avodah Zarah, what should she do with the trafim?
Destroy them
instead of sit and protect them and hide
these
them.
These may be medallions.
Right? Then we have the position of the Radak, who says that these trafim were actually like GPSs. In other words, if Lavan had them, he'd be able to find Yaakov. Right? And of course, well, that doesn't turn out to be true because Lavan finds it without it, right? Then there's actually the Radak quotes his father is saying, and it's based on Midrashim, is that Rachel actually felt an affinity for the Trafim, because where's the other famous story that we find Trafim? In whose house? In Michal's house. And Michal, of course, never has a child. So the assumption that these were some sort of fertility things, and that she may have an association with that, and there's a Midrash like that Yaakov suspected Rachel of still being involved in Avodah Zarah. All right. But Greenberg has, the simplest explanation of it. And in an article he wrote years ago, Marshall Greenberg, he says, if you take a look at the ancient texts, and again, looking back at Near Eastern texts, you'll find that the Trafim were actually a claim on the estate. Or having them was a claim on the estate. There's an ancient contract from not far from this neighborhood, from around the same time period, where somebody says, and this child will get this part of the estate, and this child will get the household gods in this part of the estate. It's like a claim on the estate. So you understand what Rachel's doing. Rachel and Leah both said, we've been sold out of the estate. Well, we don't want to be sold out of the estate. So what does Rachel do? She steals the trafim, which would be then a claim. Somebody come back and say, yeah, I'm the head of the estate. Here's my trafim.
Right.
Now, by the way, notice that this keeps coming back. Who was the first person to engineer an attempt to infiltrate this household? Rivka. Getting Yaakov to have to run away here and come into the family where there's no sons and marry the daughter, boom, boom, boom.
But there's no wealth either.
What?
There's no wealth either.
Yes, but they want to get back into the household.
But
right?
The point?
And it's a household that has known wealth in the past. Right? This is where Avram came from. It's a household that evidently has known wealth in the past. But either way, she wants somebody to be in that household. Now, Rachel and Leah, or Rachel at least with the Trafim, seems to be again engineering the same thing. It never happens, of course, but that seems to be the plan.
Are Rachel and Leah working
against Lavan or Yaakov? Against Lavan. And really against their brothers.
Because if they've made this deal that Yaakov's going to get like half the flock or whatever, so what are they laying further claims?
A claim on the estate itself. Mm-hmm. Not the capital, but the estate. On the estate.
But back in that day, women didn't typically take claim to their family's estate. They would marry to their husband.
It's not so simple. And there certainly are lots of women who show up in ancient contracts as being landowners and being much more powerful than you think.
Are we assuming that they are not aware of Yitzchak's wealth? Which Yaakov is entitled to?
We don't know what they know, and we don't know also what Yaakov knows. Yaakov doesn't know what's going back home. Yaakov hasn't heard from Rivka yet, right? So he doesn't know what's going on back home. Plus he got to Ibn Ezra that Yitzchak was poor already, right? So the whole thing's unclear. What?
He doesn't know if he'll ever get both.
Right. Right. So that's this whole thing is a big question mark, but they're trying to hold on to a claim. And if you look at it carefully, that last scene that takes place on Har Gilad, when Yaakov and Lavan face off, is presented like a suit and a countersuit. It's not just spitting on the playground. It's claims and counterclaims, and the counterclaims ultimately come down to what's Lavan claiming. Lama ganav tetelah. You got to wonder, why is Lavan so worried about one little idol that's so small you could bury it under, sit on it? Evidently, it's symbolic of something much more, not on a theological or whatever you want to call it level, but rather on a financial level, on a state level. And so that's a big part of what's going on. But that helps explain to us the whole development from the very beginning of the parasha till the end. I watched the relationship between Yaakov and Lavan, and then in retrospect, we hear Lavan's angry words at the end. Yesh Elohim la'ra'im la'harala. I have the power to hurt you. Velo, hey, I'll be chel, my lie, come make him to me tonight and said, you better not mess with Yaakov. But you hear Lavan, and again, that last scene of Lavan is like, with a clenched fist screaming at Yaakov, I could have gotten you, but your God won't help me. Now, of course, that's not what happens, because they make peace, and they make a galed, and they make a gar sahaduta, and they separate and everything else. But the last impression we get of him is that. And then what do we do midrashically is then we read back, and we kind of implant that same approach to everything that he's done before. But if you look at here what happened, the real game changer was B'nai Lavan. Absent B'nai Lavan, doesn't play out that way. And of course, God's got his plans, and God doesn't want Yaakov to stay there. And God wants Yaakov to come back. And so B'nai Lavan, maybe God's way of pushing that along. And that's Kevshid Rachmana, that's God's secrets. But hopefully this gives us a better understanding of the development through the parasha and some of the details that, if you think about it, seem to be unnecessary that are highlighted in the parasha because they really are vital for understanding what has shifted in this relationship and what the original expectations were and how they have changed.
Who do you think the B'nai Lavan are?